is based on this court's prior precedent. They explicitly found that in Bly, that garden variety neglect, such as miscalendaring a deadline or being mistaken about when that deadline was, is not sufficient to warrant equitable tolling. That similarly outlined in Mead, and that similarly...
But doesn't that just set the floor for equitable tolling by reference to the Supreme Court's Irwin case, that principles of equitable tolling don't extend to a garden variety claim of excusable neglect? So neglect that's not commonplace can amount to an extraordinary circumstance justifying equitable tolling, can it?
I would submit that neglect would not be sufficient if it's on behalf of appellant's counsel. But granted, Bly does not specifically say any sort of neglect. It refers to garden variety neglect. But the exact circumstance in Bly was this one day late filing, which is the exact same circumstance that we see here in this case. So no matter what an extraordinary circumstance could be, it is not seen in this case, because this is the type of garden variety neglect that's quite simply not contemplated by equitable tolling. And as you point out, there is Supreme Court precedent addressing equitable tolling in other contexts that similarly discusses the same test that this court outlined in Bly, and similarly discusses that garden variety neglect is not sufficient to meet that standard.
Good morning. Beyond equitable tolling, what authority do we have to override Congress's deadline?
None. So the only exception to this 30-day statutory deadline is equitable tolling. And as the Supreme Court has kind of explained in other cases, the reason for this is that Congress is expected to know about equitable tolling. And if they don't indicate in the statute that they don't want equitable tolling, then it's presumed that it would be there. So that's why an exception for equitable tolling exists. It's in line with congressional intent. It's in line with previous precedent. There is nothing else in the case law, in the statute, in other precedent that would allow another exception. So
if we wanted to develop another exception, what limitations could we place on that such that we're not gutting the rule, gutting the deadline?
But we would submit that there's not authority to establish another exception here.
Take a Judge Greenberg kind of argument, equity, just equitable principles. We've decided that one day is just too short of a miss that we're going to excuse counsel's oversight under some standard. What would govern us? What would limit us?
I think that's the exact problem with creating another exception. This court is bound by statute, and to create another exception not provided for in the statute or in the precedent would be this court's using their judgment over Congress's. And Congress was clear that there was a 30-day deadline for filing. They didn't say about 30 days. They didn't say 31 days. They didn't provide.
Well, what about the Scarborough case, Justice Ginsburg? Same 30 days, same statute, equitable principles apply.
So Scarborough was talking about how this isn't jurisdictional. So it opened the door for this court to find that equitable tolling could apply to that deadline. But in Scarborough, the EJIA application was timely filed. The issue in that case was not whether it was timely filed. It was just whether it was a jurisdictional.
No, but whether the second component of the statutory requirement had been met.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it could easily have concluded that Congress intended both to be met within 30 days. That wasn't the holding of the Supreme Court, was it?
The basis of the Scarborough case was the Relation Back Doctrine.
Yes.
And that doctrine requires that there be a timely filing, and it's for circumstances that are not major. So like a signature requirement or just...
Is one day major?
Well, there's no filing, so it's not. It doesn't address the timeliness of the filing. The relation back doctrine and the actual...
I think we're talking about a concept here, though, counsel. We're not talking about the facts of particular cases. I mean, those were the facts of that particular case. But what about Henderson? There was a congressional statute that said shall, and that was found not to mean shall. It's found to be an important procedural rule, but not jurisdictional.
Correct, and the Secretary would agree that this isn't a jurisdictional requirement as far as the EJIA application deadline, but just because it's not jurisdictional doesn't mean that the statute here is irrelevant or that it creates an exception to be whatever we want.
Doesn't case law tell the court to consider equitable tolling of deadlines on a case-by-case basis, not applying mechanical rules and observing the need for flexibility, equitable considerations?
Yes. So it's meant to be flexible and it's meant to account for a wide variety of extraordinary circumstances.
And other courts have found deadline tolling to be equitable based on some level of excusable neglect in calendaring, haven't they? Our Benson case cites examples of that.
So I'm not familiar with the Benson case. I apologize. I don't believe that it was cited in any of the pleadings. But this court established the test for equitable tolling specifically in the EJIA context. So this court in Bly outlined the factors, and it explicitly found that those factors were the extraordinary circumstance that caused the late filing and diligence on behalf of the filer. And it specifically found that just being mistaken about the deadline or miscalendering the deadline was not sufficient to meet that task. So that's precedent in this court, and this court is bound by this precedent. If they wanted to overrule it would have to be an en banc panel. So in line with precedent, appellant filing this one day late cannot meet this test for equitable tolling.
Would it even meet the test of excusable neglect?
I'm not sure. I mean, that's not the standard here, but...
We have that standard for under court rules, I guess, for late notice of appeals, right?
That's correct. I'm not entirely sure the basis by which Rule 4 comes up with that standard, but in the EJIA context, that's not the standard. And
doesn't the court have the discretion to determine whether calendaring neglect should be excused?
No, because the standard here is equitable tolling. It's the only exception to the statutory deadline. I would note when the court modified Rule 4, it did not similarly modify the EJIA Rule 39, which governed the submission of EJIA applications. So the only exception that's present in the case law in based off of the court's rules, based off of precedent, is this equitable tolling. And the test is just simply not.
Why do tardy attorney fee applications warrant more rigid treatment than untimely appeals?
I mean, I don't think that... I'm not going to second-guess Congress and the precedent of this court and the precedent of the Supreme Court on equitable tolling. I mean, again, I'm not sure the basis for Rule 4, the exception there made for excusable neglect or of where that comes from. There's no similar rule in the context of EJIA. And the only exception in the case law is this equitable tolling test, which, again, is extraordinary circumstances that caused the late filing and the diligence on behalf of the attorney or whoever is filing or asking for equitable tolling.
There are courts that use those terms interchangeably or at least relatedly, extraordinary circumstances and excusable neglect, at least suggesting that neglect can be an extraordinary circumstance.
I am not familiar with or aware of particular cases that you are talking about, but if you look at this court's precedent, they don't do that. And even if you look on Rule 4, there is a distinction made between equitable tolling and neglect standard. And if you look at Supreme Court precedent and other cases, they are clear about this equitable tolling test, that it's the extraordinary circumstances, the due diligence, the causation that I previously discussed. And if you look at Federal Circuit precedent in the context of in other contexts, such as the NOA context, they hold this test apply for equitable tolling still. So I don't think that there's any flexibility here to reinterpret the test. The precedent is clear as to what constitutes equitable tolling.
It seems that the Supreme Court and our court focus entirely on this Irwin standard of no garden variety neglect. So there's got to be some level of neglect that's not commonplace that rises to the level of an extraordinary circumstance under that test, doesn't there?
I don't believe so. There's actually Supreme Court precedent, Menominee Indian Tribe v. United States specifically, that seems to indicate that the extraordinary circumstance can't even be anything within your control, because the whole idea of this doctrine is that it's an extraordinary circumstance happens to you, and despite that, you are still pursuing your rights diligently. That's the whole kind of idea behind this equitable tolling. It's not meant to be a broad exception. It's meant to account for, you know, extraordinary circumstances, but be flexible enough to not define that narrowly where you're not catching other extraordinary circumstances.
Anything else?
Yes. Yeah. So I would just note again that appellant here missed the deadline. And I would also note that when you're considering what the other side here is saying, I think this needs to be interpreted within the context of the fact that the petitioner who submitted this EJIA application was experienced. She had been practicing before this court since 2013, entered her appearance in more than 300 cases, gone through the EJIA process numerous times, and was able to correctly calculate this deadline numerous times. She was familiar with the court's rules, which are clear about this deadline. She should have been familiar with the statute, and if she was not familiar with the court's rules or the statute or the case law, she had opportunity to look those up and become familiar with them. I would also note that in the EJIA application itself, appellant's counsel billed both for calendaring final judgment when the judgment was put on the docket, and then also reviewing the mandate and calendaring the EJIA deadline. So she didn't just rely on what this court said. She investigated it, and she had the opportunity at that time to raise any sort of confusion or problems that she may have run into.
Is there any suggestion that she acted in bad faith?
I don't have any suggestion that she acted in bad faith. I think this was really just an error on her part.
Well, shouldn't we consider that? I mean, she won the case for her client, the veteran, a favored group of litigant by Congress. Shouldn't we consider that? First of all, it's part of the statute. You have to be a prevailing party, don't you? She was a prevailing party, or her client was a prevailing party.
Yes, she was a prevailing party,
She earned her fee.
So the EJIA statute does not only provide that she has to be a prevailing party. It also provides a 30-day deadline, and it's explicit about this deadline and says that a party shall submit within this deadline. And the exception to this is equitable tolling, which, again, an error calendaring is not sufficient to meet that standard, which, again, is extraordinary circumstances, causation, and due diligence.
Is there any reason to doubt the explanation that a calendaring error occurred and that the mandate was recorded on October 15th, but the date it was entered by the court, not October 12th, the date it became effective? Any reason to doubt that explanation for what happened?
You mean that she incorrectly interpreted when the date?
Right.
I don't have any reason to doubt that, but that explanation is insufficient to meet the equitable tolling test, and it's specifically governed by the precedent in Bly and in Mead, which, you know, outlined that this type of garden variety neglect is not sufficient.
The case docket itself lists the mandate date only as October 15th, doesn't it?
No, I see I'm running out of time. May I answer the question?
Yes.
So the mandate was entered on the docket. The docketing date was the 15th, but the actual notice indicated the 12th, the correct date of the mandate. And that is in line with the court's rules that explain that that is what happens. And there's good reason for that. Your court does not always know whether an issue is appealed. And before they put the mandate on the docket, they have to confirm that there is actually a final judgment and be aware whether there was an appeal to the Federal Circuit, because then mandate would be unnecessary.
But when the mandate is docketed, it just reflects that date mandate. It doesn't also then generate an October 12th mandate effective date on the docket. There's no entry on the docket October 12th mandate effective.
So if you click on the actual notice on the docket, it will tell, like, there is a document there, and there it said mandate is effective, and it had the correct date of mandate on that. And appellant's counsel here billed for reviewing that, and she presumably reviewed that, and that is exactly how the process is supposed to work. So there is no error here on behalf of the court to the extent that there is a suggestion of that.
Appellant's counsel doesn't argue that they were misled, right?
That's correct.
And they don't argue even that their miscalendaring constituted extraordinary circumstances.
That's correct.
And they don't argue that their miscalendaring constituted excusable neglect.
Correct.
Essentially, they just throw it out there that this is unfortunate.
Correct.
And ask the court to deny your motion.
That is correct.
Anything else, colleagues, at this point? All right. Anything else? All right. We'll hear from counsel for George Roseberry.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The court should deny the secretary's motion to dismiss because Mr. Roseberry's counsel demonstrated good cause and excusable neglect sufficient to treat the EJA application.
Could you begin then where I ended with Ms. Karen? Where did they make the argument that this was excusable neglect, extraordinary circumstances, or what? I mean, I don't see that argument made in the papers.
In the Mr. Rosenberry's counsel's response to the court's order to show cause for the late timeliness, Ms. Moulter laid out her reasons which demonstrate good cause and excusable neglect. And the secretary mentioned...
Well, she laid out the reasons, but she doesn't make the argument.
Yes, Your Honor, she laid out the reasons which demonstrate good cause and excusable neglect, which think by analogy, that's what's required under Rule 4, demonstrating good cause and excusable neglect, not specifically pleading good cause, not using the magic words good cause and excusable neglect.
Okay, so she says I miscalendered it.
Yes.
This is unfortunate. I'm not going to get paid for the work I did.
No, she did not say that second part, Your Honor. That actually leads me to the beginning of the Secretary's argument. The secretary laid out two main arguments. First, that the EJA application was untimely, and Ms. Moulter agrees. She knows how the rules work. She's been practicing at this court for a while, and she agrees. Yes, it was one day late. We're talking about a one-day late EJA application. And she conceded that but she did not concede what the secretary said.
I said the word unfortunate. She actually used the word devastating.
Yes.
A little stronger than the word I used. I toned it down a little bit. She does say, though, that it's devastating that to not be compensated for the work I performed on behalf of the veteran.
Yes, it would be devastating.
Okay. Where in this single-page response to the court order does she make the argument that this satisfies the standard for equitable tolling or a lesser standard for excusable neglect, or lays out some other grounds for us to ignore the congressional statutory deadline?
Well, we would not be ignoring the congressional statutory deadline. We would be treating it similarly to another non-jurisdictional statutory deadline,
right,
like Rule 4.
Which allows us to equitably toll it, or under our court rules, to for a lesser period than for which we would equitably toll it, under a lesser standard, we would excuse it for that neglect.
Right, good cause or excusable neglect. And
right.
This court has found that a calendaring error has qualified to treat a notice of appeal as timely when it was filed within that 30-day period.
You know, I've looked at Rule 4 recently, but that is to allow for the notice of appeal to be accepted as timely for a lesser period of time than we would for purposes of equitable tolling.
Mm-hmm.
Here you're going the other direction. You're saying we're going to use that lesser standard to go beyond where equitable tolling would get us.
I see. That is actually the crux of our argument, Judge Falvey, and I want to get to that because Mr. Roseberry's counsel is not looking for equitable tolling I keep wanting to say exigent. I know it's not exigent circumstances.
Extraordinary.
Thank you. Thanks, Your Honor. Under extraordinary circumstances, she's looking for the lower standard of good cause or extraordinary neglect. I'm not saying that
You mean excusable neglect.
Now I use the word extraordinary. Excusable neglect. Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Now,
so we can set aside the equitable tolling argument.
We can set aside the equitable tolling argument, especially in a circumstance where we're talking about equitable tolling equaling extraordinary circumstances. Now, the court has not held that extraordinary circumstances are the only requirement or must be shown in order to avail oneself of equitable tolling or in order to use equitable tolling reasoning in these situations. There is no decision of this court that says equitable tolling equals, in all circumstances, a showing of extraordinary circumstances or requires a showing of extraordinary circumstances. But we do know that when, in some cases, this court has looked to equitable tolling, it has held other instances to that standard. But it never said that it has to, and it may not do anything else. So that goes into...
Would the other elements still... I mean, so you want a lesser categorization for the first prong of the equitable tolling standard, something other than extraordinary circumstances, but you'd still need due diligence and causation.
Well, right? We're arguing more if equitable tolling under extraordinary circumstances is not my favorite argument in this situation. We're not waiving it. But I think that the more applicable ones would be good cause and excusable neglect, and especially when we go and.
Excusable neglect would still have to cause the late filing. There's
going to
be a linkage, right?
Reasons for the neglect, yes, would have to cause the late filing. And under Benson, Ms. Moulter has satisfied all of the elements of what would be considered excusable under the excusable neglect test.
Right. I'm having a little trouble, though, with if the excusable neglect here, the miscalendaring, caused the late filing, how would due diligence work with that? Because basically you're saying, well, I wasn't diligent. And excuse me for that.
Sure.
So how do you show due diligence, the fact that she was able to, within one day of being late, file it? So that shows that I was preparing the filing, and I didn't just completely neglect this?
No, Your Honor. The due diligence, when it has been discussed specifically in extraordinary circumstances terms only applies during the period of extraordinary circumstance. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about some more general due diligence. So was Ms. Molter acting diligently during the 30-day period and from the period of time that she made her mistake, despite due diligence, to the period of time that she filed her EJIA application? I'll tell you, Ms. Molter had no idea her EJIA application was one day late when she filed it, and she didn't know that until January when she received an email from the secretary asking for a position on a motion for the secretary to extend time to provide the response to the EJIA. So despite Ms. Molter's diligence, she made this mistake. And she did act diligently during the 30 days. The fact that she waited until the end of what she perceived to be the 30-day window in EJIA doesn't mean that she wasn't acting diligently. I actually asked Ms. Molter, why is it that you tend to file your EJIAs on the last day? And she told me because she's a solo practitioner and she tends to prioritize doing work that specifically results in getting veterans' benefits over preparing your EJIA fee application. So her EJIAs do tend to get pushed to the end of that deadline, which is diligent. And it's also very thoughtful. And like I said earlier, this was a good faith mistake. The delay was very short, and I don't think that there's really a palpable argument that the secretary has been harmed in any way by this.
Let me ask you this. Is there any harm or is there any prejudice to the veteran if we rule in favor of Ms. Molter?
No, Your Honor. No, Mr. Roseberry wants Ms. Molter to be paid for her services. We know that not only from the fee agreement, but we know that from the conversation Ms. Molter had with Mr. Roseberry when she explained to him that we're going to be having an oral argument today. He was devastated. He wanted Ms. Molter to be paid. They have a great relationship. She's helped him out quite a bit, and he appreciates her services. He decided when he was selecting an attorney at this court that he didn't want to select a volunteer attorney. He wanted to select someone who would be paid.
Aren't these factors that we should consider in making our determination?
Yes.
To the extent or the breadth, depth of these exceptions?
Yes, Your Honor. Holding that good cause and excusable neglect standards apply in this case of a one-day late EJIA and treating this EJIA application as timely because Ms. Molter has demonstrated one or both of those reasons is consistent with EJIA, and it's better for veterans, and it's also better for this court. This court has discussed a goal of having more pro se litigants represented, more what would otherwise be pro se litigants represented by counsel before their briefing reaches your desks. And one of the ways that that is accomplished is through EJIA. And this court has also said EJIA works. It's not just a theoretical, indirect concept that, oh, let's help veterans by giving money to attorneys. This court has found EJIA undoubtedly increased the availability of qualified representation to veterans free of charge. Now, I'd also like to clear up something about what Ms. Molter's statement actually did, functionally speaking. Not only did it demonstrate reasons for showing good cause, demonstrating good cause and excusable neglect despite not using those magic words, but it never conceded that the current legal landscape allows the court to dismiss. That's what the secretary described her statement as. It never made that concession. Ms. Molter never made that concession. She's not asking for the current legal landscape to change, and she doesn't say that the current legal landscape unchanged allows or means that the court has to dismiss. What she said is the legal landscape allows the secretary to file this motion. And yes, the motion to dismiss in an instance where an EJIA is late, the legal landscape allows that. Yes. And it would be devastating if Ms. Molter were not paid her fees. Those two things were true. But there was no concession other than Ms. Molter's acknowledged one-day lateness in her EJIA application.
What's the basis for excusing the neglect here?
Well, the basis for excusing the neglect is that the delay was not short. The government's not harmed. The reason for delay was Ms. Molter's diligence, and Ms. Molter was acting in good faith.
The delay was not long, I think you meant.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The delay was short. The delay was short. The delay was one day. Pardon me, Your Honor. Thank you.
What if it was 2 days?
Under Townsend, that's still a short delay. Townsend was a 3-day delay, but I think I know
it. Okay, so 4 days?
Sure.
Now, where would draw the line? And in other words, what's the standard by which we judge excusable neglect, if we would go down that line.
Sure. I'm sure that the court and the rulemaking committee asked this question when drafting Rule 4, and that's when and Rule 4 provides that guidance. So that guidance is under 30 days. And then after that, it's held to a higher standard of equitable tolling, with extraordinary circumstances. So that would be, good faith, excusable neglect under 30 days. And then after 30 days, we're looking in a at a higher standard in order to treat a filing as timely. And I mean, there's a great parallel here, and the court has drawn that parallel in Mead between the treatment of late notices of appeal under Rule 4 and litigants seeking to file or seeking to have treated as timely a late EJIA application.
Now, Rule 4 was a rule change, essentially by the en banc court, since it is something that's considered by the Board of Judges and voted on and everything. What authority does this panel have to, in essence, change our rules?
This panel has the authority because the rule, it's because I'm not asking for a rule change. Down the road, the rules can be recorded in a book. This approach can be recorded in a book. But even as Coley notes, Rule 39 doesn't say anything about equitable tolling. Rule 39 doesn't say anything about extraordinary circumstances, yet the court still does it. There are exceptions, as Coley says, to the 30-day window in
the EJIA statute, even though they're not written. The Federal Circuit have told us what the standard is there.
Sure, what one of the standards may be there. Yes, we know what that is. And this court has discretion when higher courts and Congress have left room open to create other standards. It doesn't have to be written down in rule. So I'm not asking this court to draft a rule right now or to erase a rule right now. I also want to make that clear. We're not asking for an extension or any of the consequences of asking for an extension. We're not asking for a Rule 26B change or a suspension of Rule 26B or anything like that. What we are asking for is a treatment of Ms. Moulter's EJIA application for her services for Mr. Roseberry to be treated as timely because she showed good cause and she also showed excusable neglect. Because of those reasons, her EJIA should be treated as timely.
Anything else?
I think we covered. Oh, I did want to get around just talking about the garden variety language because that is often used out of context. A miscalendaring error has been referred to as not the type of garden variety neglect to which we will apply the equitable tolling standard. Well, in that case, in Bly, the equitable tolling standard they applied was extraordinary circumstances. So that means garden variety neglect isn't an extraordinary circumstance. Okay, that's no problem because Ms. Moulter is not trying to argue that garden variety neglect, if her calendaring error qualifies as that, is an extraordinary circumstance. I also don't think that her mistake qualifies as garden variety neglect. Now, we do know from the practitioner's notes and from the court's rules that, yes, it does happen sometimes that date is docketed on a different date from the date it's actually effective. But is a garden variety neglect would be more something like failing to do the math correctly when calculating 30 days from day one. It is not reasonably looking at a docketing order, forgetting a practitioner's note, and recording from the wrong date on the docket instead of the date on the actual document of mandate. That's not garden variety. It's a little more complicated. So I wouldn't like the garden variety neglect language to be misapplied to what Ms. Moulter said or did or to what her arguments are here today, because Ms. Moulter is not trying to avail herself of extraordinary circumstances of equitable tolling through extraordinary circumstances. Now, unless the court has any more questions, I'm happy to wrap up. Looks like my judgeship.
Well, the Supreme Court case that recognized that you could have excusable neglect, even if there was inadvertence, mistake, or carelessness, was Pioneer Investment Services. But that case is much different than this one, right? Because the excusable neglect they found was neglect that was blamed on a quote here, peculiar and inconspicuous placement of a notice of the notice regarding the deadline.
Sure.
Well, we couldn't be farther away from that circumstance here, right? Because we have plain notice regarding a deadline and even elaboration, specific cautionary notes that go with the rules.
Right. Yes, Your Honor.
So how does this shortfall fit into that, even the excusable neglect
standard? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Your Honor. It doesn't have to. And it is highly analogous to it, but it doesn't have to fit within the precise facts of Irwin because this is a different court. And all of these good cause or excusable neglect standards are supposed to be applied on a very case-specific fact-by-fact basis. As you mentioned earlier, Judge Shaker, these are supposed to be there's flexibility in these rules, and there is also facts matter quite a bit in these rules. And on top of that, this is a special court. This is a special court that is supposed to look to how veterans are benefited. It is one of the factors that the court should evaluate when looking at things like excusable neglect. Neglect might have a different type of excusability in this court than it does in the Supreme Court in a different subject matter. And it should, because when balancing factors of fairness and harm to the parties, if we are going to balance the weight of those in a pro-veteran context, the harm to the veteran is more important than the harm to the government. And we even know that from the Supreme Court. In IRS v. Gene, the Supreme Court told us that public fisc concerns are supposed to be subrogated to concerns of statutory content. And we've got two statutes here. We've got the Aegis statute and the pro-veteran statute, both of which are more important than the government's purported harm about the public fisc or any complaints about one day's time being somehow devastating to the government's operations. It's also, by the way, beneficial to this court that this court continues with a system that is more helpful to pro se litigants so that they can obtain representation before their briefing reaches the judges.
What about the broader systemic interest in adherence to the rules, keeping the system moving and thereby benefiting veterans and those who represent them?
Sure. The Secretary mentioned something about this, too, saying we're just arguing for consistent rules. And I think we all are, but we want consistent rules that are the right rules, the best rules for the court, the best rules for the veteran, the best rules for the Secretary. As long as these rules are clear, we're going to have more efficiencies. As long as practitioners who come before this court know what the rules are and know what happens if you file an EJA one day late, hopefully you never do. But as long as these rules are consistent and fairly clear, and the more we approach that time when those rules do become consistent and fairly clear, the better off we're going to be and the more efficient this court's processes are going to be.
Isn't that really why courts exist? Legislatures, administrative agencies can't anticipate every single situation in statute or in rules. We're here to adjust the situation to the facts of each individual case. Is that your argument?
That is part of it, Your Honor. Yes. Yeah, we do believe that, especially where, we know under MAPU that this is a very fact-specific analysis when we look to good cause and excusable neglect. And that is part of what the court would be tasked at doing and already does in Rule 4 situations.
That's part of my issue with what we've got here is that you're right, it's very fact-specific and part of the roles of an appellate court particularly is that the parties tee it up such that we can make a determination based on those factual circumstances. Yet here we've got a single page that doesn't lay out much factual circumstances and doesn't make the legal arguments that you're making here today. So the Secretary hasn't even had a real attempt to respond to your argument that excusable neglect can be a kind of extraordinary circumstance that allows for equitable tolling, or maybe we've got a new concept that we should adopt, like Rule 4. None of that's been teed up for the court because the papers here don't make the arguments you're now making.
The papers here demonstrate good cause and excusable neglect. They don't make all of the arguments I'm making.
They don't make any of them. It's a single page.
Well, demonstrating good cause and excusable neglect is not making an argument. Those are two different things. Demonstrating good cause and excusable neglect is laying out facts.
But there she's just given a single fact.
Yes.
I miscalendered.
Yes. And that is that those are the facts underlying her.
Nothing. I was misled. I only read the docketing entry. I didn't click on the document. I didn't know the rule that says that, you know, mandate is issued before the actual docketing entry.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, if Ms. Malter had said any of those things, they wouldn't have been true. What was true was that.
I commend her for her honesty. I commend her for her sincerity, and I commend her for the brevity of her pleadings. She didn't try to concoct something. But the legal arguments you're making, she did not make.
I am making legal arguments based upon the facts that she demonstrated in her response. And although you mentioned, Your Honor, that the Secretary didn't have a chance to respond, the Secretary certainly could have asked for a chance to respond. And it's no unfair or big surprise that we're talking about Rule 4 situations, because all of the cases that we're talking about now, almost all of them make analogies between Rule 4 and EJIA deadlines, because they are, they all mention Henderson and Scarborough. They're all non-jurisdictional statutory deadlines that are subject to equitable concerns. So the fact that the Secretary didn't bring up a lot of Rule 4 arguments has nothing to do with the fact that Ms. Malter, all she did, at bare bones, laid out, demonstrated good cause and excusable neglect. But no, she didn't brief. She did not bring these things to a brief.
She didn't even say this should be excused.
She said not excusing it would be devastating to her. She did actually, lay out one of the elements of harm to her and to Mr. Roseberry if it were not excused.
Anything else, counsel?
No, Your Honor. I'll just conclude with this, unless the court has any additional questions, that the court should apply good cause and excusable neglect standards to Ms. Malter's one-day late EJIA application and treat that application as timely because it's consistent with EJIA. It's better for veterans. The court can do it, and it's better for the court and practitioners before the court.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the government.
Initially, I would just like to note that this whole argument that Rule 4 should apply in the EJIA context and specifically apply in this case is all being raised for the first time today. This court, and precedent from the Federal Circuit as well, says that this court does not have to consider belated argument and ordinarily should not consider belated argument. And previous precedent, it goes even further and says that submitting argument for the first time at oral argument is particularly objectionable and should not ordinarily be considered. So we submit that this argument should not be considered by the court since it was raised for the first time today. I would also note in this case, appellant's counsel was given multiple opportunities to raise any argument that she thought was had merit. She could have advanced argument in the EJIA application. I now understand that she didn't know at that time that she was late. But to the extent there was any sort of issue regarding calculating the EJIA deadline, she could have raised it at that point. When the secretary filed a motion to dismiss, she could have filed a response of her own accord. Instead, she waited for the court to order her to respond in the February 2022 order. And then she responded there just saying that a calendaring error occurred and that she did not dispute the secretary's, the legal landscape that allows the secretary to move to dismiss. She did not offer any argument that Rule 4 should be applied in the EJIA context. Rule 4 does not clearly apply in the EJIA context because it governs notices of appeals. Instead, there's Rule 39 that relates to the EJIA. I would also note that this case was then.
Is there any principled reason to distinguish between the two?
Between the notice of appeal context and the EJIA context?
Yes.
Well, one, there's different law. There's different case law. The rule says that it's different. But to the extent you're just asking about policy considerations, I do think that there is a difference. The notice of appeal is about a veteran's opportunity to be heard before this court. If that is waived, then the veteran never gets to have their case before this court. The EJIA context is just about the attorney being paid, and attorneys are necessarily going to be involved with the process as far as filing an EJIA application if there are attorney's fees. Attorneys are routinely asked to know the law, to know the court's rules, to apply those. It's not an onerous burden to ask them to be familiar with the law and to apply the law. So there are definitely different considerations that, from a policy perspective, are relevant and make those two situations different.
Do the benefits of having an ironclad deadline for EJIA applications really outweigh the potential detriment to veterans and their attorneys?
So Congress is the one who considers the policy considerations, and here they clearly thought that the 30-day deadline supported the statute. They included it in the statute. It has been in the statute since 1985 when it was enacted, and Congress therefore wanted this to be a part of the statute and did not think that it undermined the purpose of the statute. And I would note this 30-day deadline is the rule now. Prior to Scarborough, there was no exception to this. Attorneys operated in the space knowing that if they missed this deadline, they were not going to get paid. There are no exceptions. Then this court in Bly clarified that equitable tolling applies, and equitable tolling has applied since that point. This is the law attorneys have been operating under, and they have, it's not, you don't see it frequently where they miss this deadline. So I think what you will see in the future is the same thing that you see now, is that attorneys will be careful in calculating this deadline, calendaring out the 30 days, and if there's any kind of question as to when this 30-day deadline is, they'll refer to the court's rules, to previous precedent, and any sort of misunderstanding could be rectified at that point.
Anything else, counsel?
I would like to just go back to say also that even after the appellant's counsel, Ms. Moulter, responded to the court order and this case was called to panel, there was still a three-month period of time where appellant's current counsel could have submitted any argument, and they declined to do so. If there are no further questions, I will close.
I do have one. Do you know if we, you may not, any Rule 4 cases that we have where we have found an attorney's calendaring error to be excusable neglect?
I am not aware of any. I will admit that I haven't done a deep dive into that, given the scope of what was pleaded today, but I'm not aware of any.
Anything else?
No, thank you.
Well, you've all done an excellent job. We appreciate it, both in your written submissions and in the argument today. We will, of course, reserve opinion. And customarily, we come down and greet counsel, but under the circumstances today, I think we'll just greet counsel. And again, thank you for an excellent job from the bench. Thank you.
Court is in recess.